RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday edition, Impeachment Wednesday edition of the Dark Delight Podcast with...
Impeach Me Val.
Sounds like
and
it's a, and me beans. It's like a Valentine's Day heart. Impeach me.
Maybe I should have done like a Toni Braxton edge to it. Like unimpeach my heart or impeach my heart.
You should have.
I should have thought. No. Next year when they try impeaching him again, we'll do it.
So today, there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, we had a lot of stuff happen last night, but today we just did an interview with Ned Ryan. He's on Twitter at Ned Ryan, NEDRYUN. Ned Ryan, and he wrote this book called Restoring Our Republic, The Making of the Republic and How We Reclaim It Before It's Too Late. And so Frank, did you enjoy this interview?
I really did. And it's too bad we don't have a little bit of an end tag that we recorded, because we talked a little bit about the 17th Amendment. And there's some great things to think about with that. We got to talk about that some other time.
Oh, yeah, I know. The show is going to end today unless we record something else that without our normal. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, and RadioInfluence.com. So I just did it then.
Yeah, there you go.
But the impeachment hearing's going on. We talked to Ned about his book. He's on Tucker Carlson all the time. We delved into the Flynn case. We delved into the FISA stuff. We delved into progressivism. We delved into what happens in society if this all continues the way it is. We got into some history. We talked about his book. You guys can go to NedRyan.com. He's going to put autographed and personalized copies up there for everyone out there who wants to buy it. This is stuff that you wish you never forgot. Really, really good book. I know Frank is excited to get his paws on it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. And I have some notes I wrote over here for maybe like Friday or whenever the hell we talk about this next.
Yeah, it was I knew you were going to love it. I knew you were going to love this interview. Just knew it. Anyway, without further ado, I suppose. And we'll bring you Ned Ryan and our interview with Ned. And then Friday, we'll get back to some more detailed analysis of what's been happening over the past week. Are you ready, Frank, to show
us? Yes. Let's do it.
Off we go. So we are honored to be here with Ned Ryan, author of a brand new amazing book, Restoring Our Republic, The Making of the Republic and How We Reclaim It Before It's Too Late. Thank you for joining us today on the podcast, Ned.
Absolutely. Great to be with you guys.
Great to have you.
Yeah. So we met for the first time in person at the American Priority Conference, where you were on that awesome panel that we did about Spygate.
That was fun. That was really a fun time. I mean, it was obviously you were moderating, Tracy, and then we had Tom Fitton. We had George Papadopoulos. We had Corey Lewandowski. You know, I was on it. That was a pretty amazing panel to be on, especially since a lot of us, you know, either been commentating or living it for the last few years, and all of us on the same stage, on the same panel, talking about it. It was pretty fun 45 minutes.
That's a huge panel. That's a great panel right there.
It was. It was really good. It went so quickly, too. I was like, I had so many questions. Tom, I talked about this, how Tom was like, here's what we're going to do. I'm like, no, Tom.
Oh, yeah. I think he was under the impression there were going to be opening statements. And I think he might have had like a 10-minute opening statement. I even looked at him and said, Tom, it's a 45-minute, 50-minute panel. There's four of us plus a moderator. I'm pretty sure we should keep to like maybe 5 minutes opening comments and go from there. And he was like, yeah, I know, you know what? I think you're right.
So, he's great. He was great.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, he was so good about it. It was funny, though. I'm like, no, I have a plan. But it was great. So I bought your book immediately, and
I appreciate that.
No, it's fantastic for a bunch of different reasons. So it is like a, I don't want to, it is like a Bible sort of how we got to where we are, how the country, how the founders, things that you just don't learn anymore in school or know. And I think people are primed to relearn if they may have forgotten them. What's a summary of what this book is about? And then I want to get into some of your background too.
I mean, really, the whole point of doing this was Real, I mean, really, the genesis of it was this isn't being taught. It's not being taught in school. We're not really learning our history. We're not learning civics. And beginning of this year, you know, again, I do a lot of commentary on TV. I write opinion pieces, just this aggressive socialism that we're facing, which a lot of people, you know, instinctively know is wrong. But how are we to confront it and actually defend if we don't even know what we're defending? And so it was kind of this thing of who are we as a people? Where did our republic come from? Which I have to tell you, Tracy, it's kind of funny. Every time I go on TV and I talk about what we're experiencing and I mention republic or constitutional republic, it's really funny to see the responses on Twitter. Like, finally, somebody's using this language. And I'm thinking, well, of course, because that's what we are. And I think we've lost some of that. People, well, we're a democracy, which we are, but we're a constitutional republic, which is a form of democracy. We are not pure democracy, which I write about in the book. The founders were terrified. Actually loathed and were deeply afraid that someday the American people might give in to the idea of pure democracy, which they believe ended, you know, the golden age of Greece. And then, you know, one of the other inspirations too, I think really the last 3 years have been about something that's been building for the last 100 years, in which progressives dropped an administrative state governing philosophy inside of our constitutional republic. And by that, I mean, they dropped this massive bureaucratic state filled with unelected, powerful bureaucrats who, over the course of time, as government has expanded and expanded and expanded, thought they were the ones in charge, thought they were the ones making the decisions. And quite frankly, over the decades, Congress has ceded so much control and so much authority, and I would even argue the executive branch as well. It's kind of like, well, yeah, you have been given control, and then all of a sudden Donald Trump shows up, constitutionally elected president of the United States, and says, I'm the duly elected president. I'm the one that decides domestic and foreign policy inside of the executive branch, inside of my administration. And these administrative actors said, no, we don't think so. And Donald Trump said, yeah, no, I do think so. And that's what this is all about. I mean, if you want to look at all the madness, all the crazy, all the conspiracy theories, everything that's taken place, it's about who decides. And in a constitutional republic, it's the duly elected president of the United States that decides, not these unelected, powerful bureaucrats who need to be brought to heel. And we can talk more about this later. They need to be consequences, Tracy. People need to go to jail for what they've done.
You know, I just want to jump in there. Ned, let me ask you this. Obviously, there has been a lot of just demented views on where we are, and without having that civic grounding and why, then even the greatest constructed Bill of Rights and Constitution the world has ever seen can look to most people as just an arbitrary creation.
That's
so,
right.
You know, not even knowing where it came from, why the almost 700 years of world history led to that creation. Let me ask you a question though. As you were talking about a president showing up now and upsetting the apple cart in some way, in a modern way, the most complicated part of this infection for me is seeing how, now that we are so far along the way where the federal government employs over 2 million people.
That's right.
I have seen how conservative, liberal, all of those principles that people have about limited government or the otherwise, it goes out the window when they realize that if we really are going to restore what we had, a lot of people are going to lose their job security. How do you approach that very sensitive topic, because there's a lot of people who believe in a concept of a republic who would not have a job if we had one.
So, Frank, the topic of my next book is called The Racket, How Conservative Inc. Has Sold Out the Interests of the American People. You're right. No, I think a lot of these Republicans and conservatives come riding into town, riding into the swamp and go, we're going to break apart the administrative state. We're going to drain the swamp. And it's like, ooh, this swamp really feels like a nice, relaxing hot tub. And I've made this argument. I tell people I've been in D.C. about 20 years. I'm an outsider with an insider's perspective. Again, Dad was in Congress 10 years. I was a writer at the White House. But you watch some of this stuff that's taking place on the inside, and you realize it's kind of a sham war, right? It's kind of like a military-industrial complex issue where a lot of people want this conflict, and I'm using air quotes here, to continue – because they're not really that interested in complete and total victory, because you're right. They'd be out of a job. They would lose their sinecure and their hundreds of thousands of dollar annual salary to show up at parties and show up at the movable feast of events And look like they're doing something when in fact nothing's actually happened. And you know, one of the themes in the next book is going to be, you can't tell me that Conservative Inc. has done anything meaningful in any way for decades as our national debt's exploded to, what are we at, $23 trillion now? You mentioned the millions of federal government employees. We don't even know the exact size of our federal government. I mean that in all honesty. I wrote about it in chapter one of this book. We know there's over 430 departments, agencies, and sub-agencies inside of our federal government, but we don't actually have a precise figure on that, which is insane. As more and more spending, as we're doing more spending, you know, we're into, what, $1 trillion annual deficits now. We don't even know what we're funding. This is insane. At some point, and this is my hope. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump has been under massive attack these last 3 years. It's pretty staggering what he's been able to accomplish with this unbelievable attack from the FBI, you know, this FISA abuse, the mainstream media acting as propagandists for the deep state and the left and Democrats. Unbelievable. But what my hope is, when he gets reelected, and he'll be reelected, that he takes the second term is 4 years and starts to really think about how he breaks apart the administrative state. And I mentioned some of this in the last chapter. Shut down Department of Energy, figure out how you get 800,000 non-essential federal government employees out of government into the private sector, and remove those jobs from the federal rolls. But there have to be very aggressive steps taken in the next term if we're going to have a shot at returning to the Republic.
You know, just before you mentioned the power of the executive, and I find it really interesting, and I'm sure you've picked up on this too, that William Barr has a very, very sort of strict look at the executive's power and how much power.
That's right.
What do you think? Do you think his perspective gives the executive too much power, or does he strike a good balance between what we have now and?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things. First of all, I think Bill Barr is one of the best hires of Donald Trump's entire first term. I mean, fantastic. And I would argue too, I don't know how Barr feels personally about Trump, but I tell you what, he is determined to get to the bottom of the corruption and the abuse of power inside DOJ, the surveillance state, the law enforcement regime, FBI, all of these things, because he believes that unless we do that, obviously it's only going to get worse. And this is the one thing that encouraged me about Bill Barr. There have to be consequences for these actions, not a slap on the wrist, not people going, oh, whoops, a big oopsies, like Comey tried to claim Sunday on Fox News. No, this was intentional. This was systematic. There have to be consequences. Things have to be set right. I mean, this is kind of the debate. You ask, you know, Barr, strong executive. There's always been this debate and there's always been this tension. That's what the founders actually intended.
Right.
This diffusion of power. How do you have the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch? There has to be tension between the three to balance out where the power is to protect the rights of the American people. And I think everything's been thrown off kilter the last 100 years, not only inside the federal government, but because so much power has been consolidated into Washington, D.C., we've destroyed the idea of federalism. We've removed the states from a lot of devolving that power out. But that was what the founders intended. They wanted to diffuse power as much as possible inside this republic that they envisioned. And what progressives have done have knocked down a lot of those barriers and consolidated power into D.C.
And the problem now, and I found this really eloquent in the book, too, is you discuss very clearly, like, that power, you know, the difference in perspective between the founders and today's progressives and where power derives from, like progressives feeling as though the government doles out rights and takes care of citizens. Whereas the founders said, we're not perfect. That's why we need these rules in place, but we don't grant rights to the people. God does. And there's a fundamental perspective, ridiculous shift, disparity here. How do we... It's a little scary to ponder. How do we get through it? Like, what do we do?
So this is some of the stuff I talk about in the last chapter, especially. We used to have this common set of values. We believed in, you know, basic human rights, natural rights. We believed in transcendent truths that were above passing human whims. But really what's taken place, and in the first chapter I write about this real difference between our founders and the progressives of the earliest 20th century. Our founders were optimistic realists. They were very real. This is what the founders got right. We can have a debate. You know, a lot of them moved within a Judeo-Christian Anglo-American worldview. But at the end of the day, what, you know, most of them got right and put and codified into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is a belief that human nature is wildly imperfect, right? We're imperfect human beings in an imperfect world. We're capable of great good. We're incapable of sustained good. And at some point, imperfect human nature, and this is what the founders decided, should never be trusted with concentrated power. That is what will destroy our God-given rights. So they were very realistic about human nature. They were very realistic about the role of power and concentrated power, but they were optimistic that they could create a republic that would protect and defend as the stewards of God-given rights. Again, government does not give us our rights. Our rights come from God. There is natural rights for every human being that a government in its proper role is supposed to defend and advocate and allow the greatest amount of freedom within the bounds of ordered liberty. What progressives did when they came around late 1900s, early 20th century, is that they came into government and decided utopian statism. They were utopians and they were naive about human nature. They did not accept the idea that human nature is wildly imperfect, will never be perfected this side of eternity. And they felt that for progress to actually be accelerated, for there to be a sort of nirvana, you had to consolidate power. They've always hated the Constitution. I mean, this is the one thing that is becoming more and more clear today, but has been true for the last 100 years. Progressives have despised and hated the original intent of the founders' Constitution because of the barriers that were set up, the machinery that was set up to prevent the consolidation of power. And what progressives have done, and I would argue actually have succeeded in quite well, is consolidating power, breaking down the barriers in the republic that were meant to protect the natural rights of the American people. So, you know, Tracy, I think part of what we have to do in a greater conversation with the American people and is decide, what do we actually believe? What do we believe about human nature? What do we believe about the role of government? What should the size of government? There is a need for government. I mean, the founders even said it. Madison says it in the Federalist Papers. We're no angels. If we were angels, there'd be no need for government. We are not angels. 20th century is full of empirical evidence that we're not angels. What do we actually believe is the proper role and size of government? How should it actually, and then how do we view it? And you're right. I wrote in one of the chapters, really this transition period, again, post-Civil War, coming into the 20th century, that the American people started to view government as the giver of rights, not the steward of rights. And that's a massive, massive change in philosophy. And something that we have to address. Government does not give us our rights. God does.
You talk in the book about, this is a little bit of a different question, but you talk in the book about the traditions and where the founders got this from. So you have four different kind of boxes. It's Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, and England.
That's right.
How do you know that? Like, what writings were there that like let you know, okay, they definitely looked at Rome because blah, blah, blah. Like, how did you figure that out? And where did you get that info from?
Well, I mean, this is you look at their writings, they were huge admirers of Cicero, who I'm a huge admirer of as well. He was considered by some to be the greatest Roman orator. He was a council of Rome. He was in the last days of the Roman Republic. Very influential writer, obviously a great orator at the time, was actually, very close to the first triumvirate. They wanted him to be a part of it. And so the founders were very aware of all of Cicero's writings, not only about what was taking place during the last days of the Roman Republic, the fall of the Republic, the rise, obviously, of the new era of the Roman Empire. So this is the stuff that they were reading growing up in school, right? So you see it in their writings. They refer to Cicero as Tully. Right, they had a nickname for him because they were so familiar with his writings. You know, they were familiar with the Greeks. Again, it's they were reading these philosophers. They were reading the Plato. They were reading the Socrates. You look at obviously, I bring in ancient Israel and talk about some of those themes of God-given rights and some of these things about human dignity, all of that, and God-giving transcendent law. Again, they were raised in a day and an age when you see in their writings and see in their discussions and their correspondence. They were very well acquainted because of the Bible and the readings that they have done with these ideas. And then with England, I mean, you look at Sir William Blackstone, the great jurist, the great legal commentator. They were very familiar with his writings and the common law. I mean, the common law, English common law, which I spent a chapter discussing, these were all themes and ideas that the founders were imbued with, because they had been learning them and discussing them and being trained in them since they were the young people and getting their schooling. So it's kind of obvious. And this is the one thing, Tracy, I learned. I went to that bastion of conservative thought, University of Kansas, and I say that with the deepest of sarcasm. But the one thing I did, and I think the one thing that I really learned and have applied in my reading and my writing and commentary is the historical method. And the thing that my professors taught me at the University of Kansas, again, most of them not conservative at all, the historical method is going back to the original documents. Go back and read the original documents. See what they had to say for themselves. Don't leave it up to somebody else's interpretation. And that's why I try to cite as many original sources as possible, debates, conversations, you know, and kind of weave this story and say, hey, this is not a mystery. I mean, I even make the point, and I try and bring a little bit the Constitutional Convention to life. How can I do that? Well, because James Madison decided, even though he was not voted the official secretary of the Constitutional Convention, a young man by the name of William Jackson was, James Madison made himself the unofficial secretary of the Constitutional Convention because he wanted to take notes and let everybody know for posterity what had actually taken place inside those nearly 4 months of debates in Philadelphia. You can find all of these things if you go look for them and you can study them and you can read them for yourselves. And what I try to do, because probably most people don't have the time to do that, is then try and take it and consolidate it into this book and weave the narrative and say, there's a method to the madness. They didn't come to these conclusions. They did not build this republic by mistake. It was very intentional, and it was intentional. Here's why. Here's what their inspirations were. Here's what they intended. Here's where we've drifted, and then here's how we get back to where we started.
I almost feel like one of the questions I had when reading it for you was like, how did we get so stupid? Because I almost feel like there's nobody capable of such deep philosophical introspection now to be able to even, like, I don't think the people in this country, especially not in a position of leadership for the most part, would be able to draft the Constitution or Declaration of Independence because nobody has the self-reflection necessary. So how do we get past the hurdle of the dumb people that we have around us? Like, what do we do?
Ned, how do we fix stupid?
Yeah.
That's an age-old question, Tracy, to which I don't think we actually have gotten any real solutions to. No, I think part of it's education. I mean, this is the fact that we're not learning these things that I write about is intentional. It's intentional because it goes against everything that progressives want, right? This is against the narrative. It's against what they want people to believe about government. They might use the same terms. It's been pretty staggering just the last week, watching Democrats intone about the rule of law and this is what the founders wanted. This is what the I'm like, have you even read the Constitution? I mean, frickin' Chuck Schumer misquoted the Constitution in his tirade to Mitch McConnell. I'm like, have you even read the thing? Have you read it recently? I mean, it's become insane. It's been an intentional dumbing down of the American people through our education system because, quite frankly, people don't want this. They do not want people to understand where they've come from, because if they understand where they've come from, they're going to wake up at some point going, we are very far away from where the founders intended us to be. And at that point, they're going to go, we've been sold a bill of lies, which we have been.
Well, you know, Ned, one of my favorite John Adams quotes is how our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people, and it's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And when you take away any kind of moral compass from the public eye or anything like that, and you strip away things in this postmodernist way of seeing the world, and in saying that even having a moral compass in itself is too restrictive and oppressive and should be rejected. I mean, really what it comes down to is I know that there's ideological wars that are being waged right now, but you brought up and you've used the word intention a number of times. And I also wanted to just get some thoughts on you about, you know, that old phrase, how the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And for all the talk of progressivism here, the Republican Party was the first progressive party. And
that's right.
You have a politically bankrupt Democrat Party coming out of Reconstruction. They pretty much sold their soul to progressivism and leapfrogged over the Republican Party in going into the left. And I mean, for example, Teddy Roosevelt, our first progressive president of the 20th century, can anybody say he was lacking in patriotism or he wasn't a rugged individualist and an ardent outdoorsman? But he created the National Park Service, and now we have federal ownership of land that that it should be relegated to only a couple of square miles in D.C. And it kicked open the door to rationalizing the reasons why we needed the EPA and everything else. So road to hell, paved with good intentions.
Well, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. And a name that a lot of people don't know as well as Teddy Roosevelt is Robert La Follette. And again, it's the law of unintended consequences. And I talk about this a little bit because I think one of the worst things that the progressives did, among many things, right? There's a whole laundry list of things they did wrong, was the passing of the 17th Amendment. And the 17th Amendment, just so we're clear, is the direct election of senators. And people are going to go, Ned, why are you opposed to the direct election of senators? Because that's not what the founders intended. The founders actually intended for the state legislators to actually appoint and be involved in appointing the senators to the U.S. Senate, to actually tie them to their states, to anchor them to their states. The founders envisioned that the Senate would be the state's house, right? We have the House of Representatives. It's the people's house. It's closely tied to the people. It's always been direct election. It's two-year terms, people's house. The Senate was always supposed to be the state's house so that senators, the two senators coming from each individual state, was to go represent the interests of the state. And if they did not, they would be recalled. And for the first 123 years of our republic, that's what we did. Well, Robert La Follette out of Wisconsin, and there was real corruption. This is the one thing that I addressed. There was real corruption with the railroad corporations at the turn of the 20th century. These railroad corporations were buying influence with the party bosses. The party bosses were then influencing the various state legislators and making sure that they were the ones appointing the U.S. senators that were actually compliant to the railroad corporations' interests. So there was real corruption. There was real influence peddling. And so Robert La Follette comes sailing in and goes, we've got to break this. We cannot have this undue influence. We should go to the direct election of U.S. senators so that we can get rid of this undue influence from the party bosses and the railroad corporations. Well, now we have 100 little kings walking the streets of Washington, D.C., who, quite frankly, are detached from the interests of their states and have made federalism a complete farce.
Oh, yeah.
But if I could, you mentioned something, Frank. I just want to, the quote about John Adams about moral people. At the end of the book, I write this. I'm just going to read a quote. The morality of a government is really just the reflection of individual morality. When we say that decline is a choice, it's the choices of the individual and what he or she chooses to accept that leads to decline. These choices are intentional, thus the belief in individual responsibility and self-government. For a healthy, self-governing republic is built upon and is a reflection of a society of self-governing people. But the self-governance grows out of a moral system. For why govern oneself unless there's a belief in right and wrong and actual consequences and rewards, both temporal and eternal, for those actions? The founders had very specific ideas on the moral framework that provided and gave order and a basis for self-governance. And I quote Clinton Rossiter, "The men of 1776 believed that the good state would rise on the rock of private and public morality, that morality was in the case of most men and all states the product of religion, and that the earthly mission of religion was to set men free." We've kind of lost that perspective on life. We've lost this idea that, you know what, if we are truly going to be a self-governing republic in which we the people have a government of, by, for the people, self-governance really grows out of self-governance of each individual governing themselves. And this is progressives thought a massive administrative state, a massive bureaucracy was a sign of health. I would actually argue that is a sign of sickness for a society, because at some point there has to be peace and prosperity and stability in a society, right? Well, we're either going to govern ourselves to bring that, or we will be governed to bring that. And the idea that we have to learn how to self-govern ourselves again is something that has to be encouraged. We have to understand. And then it comes back to, well, why should we govern ourselves? Why should I do right? Why should I do these certain actions that might cause me to have personal sacrifice? Then we have to have a conversation about, well, what do we actually believe about ultimate transcendent law and what's right and wrong? I mean, these are some big fundamental questions that we as a society need to start having again because of the implications of where it will lead us if we don't.
Before the show, we were talking about the fact that we can't even define the word woman anymore or man anymore. So how do we, like, that's the thing. And this is where, Frank, I want you to pipe up a little, because you were the first person when we were having one of our normal, like, talks on the show to mention this. At some point at the end of the day, the only way that this is going to end, if we can't have the conversations, Ned, that you're talking about, is by force. And you address this in the book, too. So you go, if share your perspective, Ned, but I want Frank to share his too, because it's really intelligent and I think you'll appreciate it.
At some point, you're right, Tracy. Again, this is one of the things where I debate lefties on TV. I'm watching Democrats spout crazy ideas and they're using these terms, rule of law. There have to be, you know, consequences, constitutional, right and wrong. And I'm thinking, how are you defining that? How do you define? And then I remember having this debate one time. I was on a panel with Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post. Well, you know, Donald Trump has lied so much about these things. We have recorded so many times that he's been, you know, not factual at all. And I'm thinking, who's facts? Who's truth? You guys didn't want absolute facts or truths. You wanted moral relativism. So it's led us to this place where all we're left with are competing opinions. So we have a society now with competing opinions because we can't even agree on how to define words because we have no fundamental basic understanding or acceptance or agreement on what we actually mean. And at some point, society cannot stand that tension. I write about this, that people desire peace and prosperity, right? And they're willing to live with a certain amount of illusions to get those things. But at some point, the music stops and people go, we really have been living a lie. We've been living an illusion. At some point, you have to have something that orders society. And if we can't have the idea of absolute transcendent truth, well, somebody's opinion has to win out. So there can be peace and order. And at some point, the only way that you can force and compel somebody to accept your facilitated truth is by force. That's a very ugly place to be in, something that we can avoid, but is going to lead to, you know, deeper, longer conversations about what we actually believe.
Yeah, no, and that's, I mean, it can only go in that direction after a while. And, you know, you were talking about defining terms. I always keep that Voltaire quote very close to me. If you wish to converse with me, define your terms.
Yes.
And it's because we're at a really upsetting and off-putting point in our history where you think that we would at least have the basic things in common, but when you sit down to talk to someone, you realize you're using the same words, but you're having different conversations.
That's right.
And I would even posit that even when we talk about conservatism and progressivism, it's so skewed because you think about it in this way, progressives are really the conservatives now. They own the current reality and are trying to conserve what they have.
Right.
You know, conservatives, we think we're conservatives because we're thinking about a world that we can only read about in the history books and we're trying to get back to it. We're the progressives, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, there's so many different – it's like staring into a kaleidoscope, Ned.
Well, this is also, again, a great debate to be having about what does it mean to actually be a conservative? What do we actually believe that means in this day and age? And I think Republican Party has been corrupted. I think conservatism has been corrupted, kind of what I alluded to earlier about the racket. But I've been pretty blunt about this on TV. I mean, Tucker and I got into it. We were in agreement, to be clear, about the vulture capitalists. Who I think have bastardized what it means to have a free market, free trade, and entrepreneurial system that actually benefits the American people. In fact, they've rigged the system now to benefit their own special interests, right? To the Kochs, the Paul Singers of the world, to benefit themselves and to fund politicians and to fund think tanks that are promoting ideas and pushing policies that are antithetical to the American worker. At some point, and this is what I tell people, I'm like, if you think that somehow when Donald Trump leaves office 5 years from now, that he is going to – that somehow America First National Populism is going to go away, I've got news for you. It's not disappearing anytime soon because Donald Trump has been that red pill, right, from the Matrix, red pill. People are awake now, and he's been a truth serum. He's brought clarity to the situation, which people understand not only about our government, I think, I hope, but also about the party, about Conservative Inc., all of these things. And they say, no, we're not going to back to status quo. We are fully woke now.
Yep.
And at what point do we say, no, we are going to have a real legitimate movement that will continue on for decades that is America First National Populist that benefits the American people? I was writing about this probably 7, 8, 9 years ago in Pursuit of Americanism. At what point do we decide we are not about Democratism, we are not about Republicanism, we're about Americanism? And this is an idea and a concept that I think a lot of the American people are going, yes, this is what we want. We want a system of government that actually benefits us.
And the two-party duopoly or monopoly, however you want to call it, has made people feel like they need to fit into one of those two boxes. So they never had a name for that feeling, but I think it's been there. The whole
Absolutely.
Time. So we're at a different place now. And I think, like you said, it's all because of Donald Trump. You know, when I always say, being in media, there is no objective fact anymore, where there are literally lies just peddled about, like, you know, the uncontested facts in the impeachment case, right? That one just throws me for a loop every time. I was on with Pags last night saying how it's backwards, ass backwards, how they could possibly say this to people with a straight face. We had that woman behind them yesterday laughing her butt off when they said that.
Without proof. without evidence, they're making these statements. And we don't, I have to say this, Tracy, having dealt with a lot of media over the years, I am a firm believer in a free press. I'm also a firm believer in the free press that is honest about the facts and honest, most importantly, about who they are. I've written about this. It's time for the New York Times to just come out and rebrand itself and say, we're the New York Times Progressive, right? And it's the Washington Post Democratic. This is how it used to be. No, it used to be this way about 100 years ago, where the various publications were identified with, and you knew they were either a Republican publication or they were a Democrat publication. There was no trying to gaslight the American people that we are pure as driven snow. We are coming down like Moses from Mount Sinai with the unadulterated truth. And if you idiots don't believe us, well, there's something wrong with you. No, we've seen the farce, people. We get it. You're propagandists. You're coming from a left-wing, narrative trying to drive that. You're not reporting facts. You're not interested in the facts. You're interested in driving a narrative. So please stop already. You're embarrassing yourselves.
You don't think that – so you look – you're on Tucker all the time. I love when you go on Tucker because we've played a bunch of your clips. No, it's great. And we're going to get into your background in a second because people really need to know, where you came from and stuff. But – what do you think it is? The ratings for the shows that really are with integrity and honest, right? Regardless of what you think about the network they're on, they happen to all be on Fox, and there's only three of them.
Right.
There's only three. It's not Martha McCallum, okay? And there's a reason for that. Not that I'm, I don't want to knock too many people, but you know what I'm saying. Are the ratings like that because Americans crave this integrity, or because the left is just as active, right? So why aren't CNN's ratings higher? What is going on?
Because I think at some level, I've always argued this again through American Majority trainings, all that the American people have a very deep rooted and innate sense of common sense and fairness. And when they are able to get the facts, their common sense kicks in and they are able to make, for the most part, right decisions. The problem is they are struggling to find out what is taking place. They're not being given the facts. They're not being given the truth. And so they're desperate to try and understand, I think, at some level, what is actually going on? Is somebody trying to spin me here? Is somebody feeding me a line? Who is going to be honest with me and tell me what is actually going on a fundamental level in Washington, D.C. right now, or anything in the news, both domestically and on a foreign front, foreign policy front? And so they're desperate for that. So they're looking for more outlets like that to please say, just tell me the truth, no matter how brutal it might be, however ugly it might be. I just want you to be honest with me. Please give me the truth. And that's why I think Tucker's at 3.4 million viewers average on every night. Hannity's a little above that. Laura's a little below that. But these are shows that are crushing it, and they're crushing it because they're trying to be as honest with the American people as possible with the unadulterated truth.
It's interesting because, there's this, what I'm noticing more and more is there's this lack of allegiance to a party. Whereas 5 or 10 years ago, it was how dare you? When I worked on the Ron Paul campaign at a level, and people were mocking us. We were the deplorables that we were getting spit at. How dare you come in here and try to upset this apple cart? I think that if the times had been kind of, different, this allegiance to this kind of neoconservative ideal, knowing that the blindfold has been ripped off for most people, they would look at the past completely differently.
Yep. No. There's been an awakening. I was a little ahead of the curve, to be honest, Tracy. I started doing some things. We started doing what I called post-party summits back in 2010 with American Majority, because I really felt like we were moving into an era in which party identification, party loyalty was not nearly as important as people wanted to have leaders that would actually advocate on their behalf and for their interests. And it really didn't matter to them. And it was really kind of it was the beginning of populism, which I think is also evident on the left, which terrifies me because the left's populism ends very badly.
Yeah.
Whereas Donald Trump has been the flag bearer and the advocate for what I would call a constitutional responsible populism. At some point, the American people are going, populism is coming awake. And now I think we're starting to finally see it come fully awake. And the question is, where do we go from here? But I tell people too, we are a two-party system. It's been that way for centuries. But you can make a party a creature of your own creation. Party is what people say it is. And the people who say what it is are those that show up conventions and win primaries.
Yep.
And at some point, I think the national populist America First types have to understand You're going to have to go run as precinct chair. You're going to have to go run as your county chair. You're going to have to actually make a party a creature of your own creation. It's going to take a little time and effort, but it can be done.
Frank pays very close attention. He's very, we always talk about how important local, like local, hyper-local politics is. And that's one of the ways that we kind of took over a convention in 2012 was by taking over locally and grabbing delegates that way, because that was the only way that we were going to be able to have any say on how the party moved forward or do anything. And, you know, we were looked at as like kind of like the anarchists trying to run away, but we were really trying to bring us back to what we're talking back today.
Well, you know, Tracy, we were talking about the 17th Amendment before. You want to talk about locality? Pretty much the 17th Amendment, in essence, put a electoral college system in every state. So, so when you look at your state legislatures that are actually going and appointing senators to go and represent the state in the Senate, remember the what's that, Ned?
No, this is completely right. This has been my argument that if we can return this again, people are like, well, Ned, that's almost impossible. You can't repeal the 17th Amendment. Why don't we have that conversation? And instead of dismissing it out of hand, let's have that conversation, because you're right, Frank. What it does is it drives it back to the local level, in which all of the sudden people are going to go, wait a minute, I have to actually be involved in a real way in my legislator's race. State legislature. And I think it then renews, because I write about a lot of, you know, de Tocqueville and Democracy in America, but his idea of the local township being the very basis for freedom, for individual freedom. You know, we hear the quote, you know, laboratories of democracy, but he really argued that the township and people being engaged in a local level was how people put into practice, you know, their freedom and their rights. And because of that, if more and more people will do that, they will learn actually how to use their freedom in a responsible way at the local level. Enough people do that local level, state level, it rises from there. Progressives did that. The progressive movement percolated from the ground up as a state and local reform movement, rose all the way to the top, you know, obviously fundamentally changed our government, and I would argue our society as well.
Yeah. So before we go any further, because I want to get your thoughts on current events and stuff that's going on, Flynn, the FISA report, stuff like that. Tell us about you. Who are you, Ned? Who are you?
Well,
tell us how you feel, Ned.
Tracy, if I was a tree. No. So who am I? So people look at the last name, Ryan, R-Y-U-N, and go, are you related to the Olympian? I'm like, yes, I am. So my dad, Jim Ryan, three-time Olympian, world record holder in the mile, just a legend in Kansas, grew up in California, and then moved back to Kansas when I was about 9 years old. And my dad had promised he would never do two things in life. He would never be a track and field coach, and he would never, ever run for office. Well, in 1996, obviously Bob Dole's running for president. He vacates his seat in Kansas, Senate seat. Sam Brownback decides he's going to run for Senate, vacates the second congressional district. My dad was approached by Matt Schlapp and Todd Tehart when he was running the Olympic torch through his hometown of Wichita and said, hey, have you thought about running for Congress? My dad's like, no, that's crazy. I would never do that. And then he and my mom talked and prayed on the way home. And 3 weeks later, he files to run for the second congressional district, wins, is in for five terms. As soon as I graduated from the University of Kansas with degrees in English and history, I thought, you know, I should go try out this D.C. thing for a year or two, just see what it's like. 20 years later, here I am, married with four kids. But when I was in D.C., you know, worked at a Tom DeLay's PAC, of all things, then went from there and was during the presidential transition for Bush's first term, went to the Pentagon, was Air Force Public Affairs, kind of an interesting period. But I tell people, the Pentagon is where creativity goes to die. Left there the spring of 2001 because there was an opening in the White House for presidential writer. And people go, what's the difference between that and a speechwriter? We did all the special correspondence. We did all the presidential proclamations. Anything that was not a speech, we wrote. And we would crank out a ton of content every day. Did that for a while. Then, you know, as a, you know, part of a common theme throughout my life, got deeply bored, left, went and helped my dad raise some money. And then from there, went and started a youth organization. I was homeschooled for a period of time. Started something at Homeschool Legal Defense called Generation Joshua, which was a practical application, kind of some of this that we're talking about today. How do you actually understand your history and civics? And then what's a practical application of it? Because this is one of my big themes throughout my entire, you know, public career. It's one thing to actually know something, But just knowing something and talking about something and writing a freaking white paper about it means nothing. How do you actually put it into action to apply it to make it a reality in the real world? And so that whole idea of that youth organization was to say, okay, you're learning about these things. Now let's go put it into action. So I would organize teams of upwards of 150, you know, teenagers with their parents, and we'd go knock on doors and make phone calls the last 4 or 5 days of an election. And then as I started to look at around 2007, 2008, you know, what's the left doing? What has the left been doing that we should try to recreate? Had some conversations with people, the genesis for American Majority, because the left has been doing what we've been doing at American Majority for a very long time. And what we do is we go identify and train people to run for state and local office. Because I'm a big believer politics is policy, mm-hmm. that people want to talk about all these policy ideas, but unless you're in the right place to implement policy, you're just having a great conversation, right? So you got to win politically. So American Majority is all about, here's how you win. Here's how you put together a get out the vote plan, campaign plan, fundraise, you know, do social media, all of these things so you can actually run a good campaign so you can win, so you can implement the right policy. So that's been the last 12 years that I've been doing American Majority. We're a C3 and a C4. And then I got the genius idea, and I say that with some sarcasm because it shortened my life, that we should figure out how to empower these state and local candidates with powerful data and technology based off what the Obama campaign did in 2012 and did it very effectively, by the way.
Yep.
So that was kind of the genesis. We did a minimally viable product in 2012, then launched Voter Gravity, which is a database software program, in 2013. It's something that a lot of state and local people have used, a lot of state legislators. We were just over in England. I would have some quibbles. I would quibble a little bit with how the Brexit party used the Pericles system, which is voter gravity in England. And then about four years ago.
I just want to stop there because you gloss over that like it's nothing. You literally powered Brexit.
So we powered the Brexit party. So a little bit of short history on the English elections. UKIP was Nigel Farage's first party, right? This was the whole idea. He was going to make Brexit happen. And he and a couple others were the ones pushing Brexit back in 2016, which, again, before Donald Trump won, was one of the most staggering, I thought, election results in recent times. So out of that, Nigel took a little bit of break from politics and then came back and said, wait a minute, they're screwing up Brexit. We can't have this happen. We've got to figure out. He started a new party called the Brexit Party, which just stunned the world, you know, less than a year ago, and putting the most people into the European Parliament out of England, beat out the Conservatives, beat out Labour. And so they were like, we want to take a run at the English elections and see if we can't win seats in the House of Commons and actually force the issue. You have to have Brexit. Of course, Nigel was pushing for a hard Brexit. Boris, not as much, but at least he was. You know, he wants to see Brexit happen. So the Brexit Party ran candidates in hundreds of districts in the recent elections, then narrowed it down to dozens, then narrowed it down to a few. Did not go well, but they did take a pound of flesh out of the Labour Party, and I think allowed in some ways, you know, the Conservative Party to win the staggering majority that they did. But yeah, no, we've been involved over there through Pericles with the Brexit Party the last 6 months, 7 months. Was a little disappointed, to be completely honest, about the results. Last week, but that all to say, if Boris Johnson will do Brexit well, I think Nigel's going to walk away and go triumph. You know, check that box. We won. We're going to have Brexit. We're going to get out of the European Union. I have to tell you, it's staggering to me that England has allowed this to go on for about 40 years because they're basically, I think 75% of the English laws are being determined by and passed by the commissioners in Brussels, who, by the way, just so people know, they're not elected. The European Union commissioners are appointed by the president, who I call the unelected dictator of the European Union. He appoints these commissioners who make the laws. 75% of English laws are actually passed down to them from Brussels. They are not a self-governing people. This is the problem when you start to have a globalist worldview take over. You end up being governed by people in a faraway country that have nothing in common with you.
Yeah, it's the thing about all this, why I'm focused on it so much, is because people are always saying, well, the left has this, the left has that, they're doing this, they're doing that. Why is there never anyone on our side who comes up with stuff? We have it. You're just not hearing about it.
Well, partly because the party doesn't like me, but that's another whole story.
Then you're our best friend, because a lot of the people in the party don't like people who call them out, and it's a problem for them. But guess what?
And this is the one thing where I think people have to understand: the party is not an end to itself, right? The Republican Party is not an end of itself. It's a vehicle by which you achieve your political ends. And I think you've got a lot of people there again, the kind of the industrial complex. No, party is an end to itself. We win no matter what. And a lot of these corrupt consultants, they win no matter what. Even if their candidate loses, they've got their commissions and they get their, you know, new car, new house, all that stuff. That's not the point. The point is to actually win. It is a vehicle by which you achieve your political ends. The America First National Populists have to make a serious run at taking the Republican Party. I think this is something that Trump should do in his second term. He's going to have to readjust some of this stuff and say, we're going to take a run at making the Republican Party a true America First party over the next 4 years.
Yeah. Hold on one sec. All right. So I want to go to current events now because you have an awesome perspective. And I find myself cheering because I would probably say most of the same stuff you're saying. Let's focus first. You talked about how you had a position inside the White House doing the writing that you were doing. What did you think about this letter that President Trump wrote into the record yesterday?
I mean, this is why people love him. This is why he has this, there's mind melt on the left. I was making fun of one of the journalists going, I can't even believe this rant was put into an official letter from the President of the United States to the Speaker of the House. I'm like, you know, propagandists can't understand this, whereas the rest of the American people are cheering it on.
Yep.
I mean, this is why they love him. This is why he got elected in 2016. This is why he's going to get elected in 2020. He's not into these niceties. He's, you know, he's one of these things. First of all, he's authentic. I mean, there's no question. People are like, well, you know, they're not doing press conferences anymore at the White House. They're not doing press briefings. Are you freaking kidding me? You have the President of the United States who tweets like 20 times a day. If you have any questions about what he's actually thinking on almost anything, you're an idiot. Yeah. Like at some point, it's like, yeah, this is why the American people are. And then they're like, you know, Ned, these tweets, they make us so uncomfortable. Like, you know why people love it? It's because they say these exact same things in private. And the President of the United States is saying these things to his 60 plus million Twitter followers because everybody's like, yeah, that's what I'm saying in private. And he's saying it on Twitter. So, I mean, it was epic. I mean, the fact of the matter is, could you even envision any other Republican that ran in 2016 having the guts to actually go into D.C. to the swamp and say, nah, I know that's how things have been running for decades. Not how it works with me here. I'm not going to put up with this. I don't accept any legitimacy in this impeachment inquiry. Again, I said this in the Tucker last week. To use the word impeachment implies constitutional order. There's nothing constitutional about anything Democrats have done, right? They've denied the will of the American people. They've denied the peaceful transfer of power. They've set themselves above the Constitution. And so Donald Trump's saying, nah, none of your stuff's legitimate. I'm not buying it. I don't have to buy it. I don't have to accept what you're doing as being legitimate on any level. And I'm telling you, they're going to impeach him, right? I think we all know that enough of these 31 Democrats in swing districts and the Trump districts are going to vote. They're going to end their political careers to vote him out, to then send to the Senate where he's going to get acquitted. You know, the question is, what does that process look like? My hope is that it's actually a long, painful, soul-sucking trial, 5, 6, 7 weeks at a minimum, where you bring in all of these idiots, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, Eric Ciaramella, you bring in Glenn Simpson, you bring in Adam Schiff, you bring in Comey, Brennan, Clapper, all these people, put them under oath, put them on national television, say, let's have a little conversation about what you've done over the last 3 years in abusing the surveillance state and abusing law enforcement and abusing the FISC, all of these things and the conspiracy theories that you have pushed. Heck, I even want them to call in some of the mainstream media propagandists.
They're criminally complicit, Ned, in my opinion.
I think so.
Because
absolutely,
you have people like we talked about the Willard over the weekend on the last show. These are people that are literally working in or formerly worked at very high levels in the DNCC, physically attacking peaceful, innocent women and one man who were at a party, a Christmas party across the hall from them, all because they believe, for the most part, some of them anyway, believe the lies that they've been fed for years. And if McConnell were going to do what you suggest, he'd have to be honest. So would Lindsey Graham. Let's be honest. Listen, they're involved in this crap, so they don't want it coming out.
Little Linz. No, I mean, Lindsey even said, and I excoriated them in a piece for American Greatness that got front pages at Real Clear Politics. Lindsey Graham saying that he didn't want any witnesses for a Senate trial. Well, how's that a trial? That's not even a trial. They have to call in witnesses. I think what's going to happen is at some point they're going to figure out how to bring in some witnesses, I would hope, give Donald Trump his due process. I mean, this is the amazing part to me. The rights that an individual citizen guaranteed by our Constitution, the President of the United States has been denied. He's not been given due process. He's been massively abused. And now you have Republican senators like Lindsey Graham saying, eh, let's just move on. I would consider a Senate trial, again, with air quotes, without witnesses to be nothing more than an attempted cover-up of what's taken place over the last 3 years.
Well, you know, I've been saying, Tracy, it's you have people on the left who are a little bit more mask off desperation. They got to do what they got to do. And there's plenty of people on the right who are just trying to coyly survive the next 4 to 8 years. That's there's a lot of people just trying to survive and try to stay out of limelight and try to play. I don't know. You know,
this is why Lindsey Graham is stepping down from judiciary. Right.
Yeah. And
this is unheard of that somebody would of their own volition step down after 2 years from being the chairman of a powerful committee in the Senate. He's stepping down. He doesn't want to get to the bottom of this. I'm telling you, Lindsey Graham, he admitted enough in his opening statements the other day to realize he's more complicit in this than people want to, you know, that he wants people to actually know. But he left a few crumbs out there. People going, wait, what did you just say?
You got the dossier when? What?
Yeah. What? Your buddy John McCain did what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is where I'm at, and I love your perspective on it. I look at what the left is doing right now, and I get a little bit frightened because they're really throwing it all out there, shooting this fiery arrow into a hay bale in a barn full of hay for what? On nothing. It's kind of troubling that they're willing and this desperate to do this. At the same time, the Senate knows that they cannot vote to remove this president. Otherwise, there would be civil war. I'm convinced of it. Convinced.
There would be a very. I would not actually argue against that, Tracy. I think there'd be a very strong negative reaction. At what level would it rise to? I don't know, but it would not be good. It would not be good for the country. I mean, I made this argument again. We have 23 Republican senators up for re-election in 2020, where the president has 95% approval rating in the Republican Party. Only the idiots, of which Pierre Delecto and Mitt Romney only get one vote, so don't worry, people. Murkowski, Collins, and after that, I think it's anybody's, you know, who would actually vote against him. And then you might have Joe Manchin and some others, Democrats, voting for Trump and saying we're not going to remove him from office. So I think it's kind of a toss-up as to what the actual final vote looks like. They're going to get nowhere near the 67 votes needed to remove him, which is kind of funny. I have to tell you, based off some of the stuff that Fredo has said on CNN and others, I think they're under the impression, because this is how stupid they are, that somehow impeachment means Trump's going to be removed from office. I'm like, you really are stupid. You don't understand how
to
fuck.
No, well, Ned, they all think that, Ned.
They don't know it.
Ned, that is why it's trending on Twitter today. People think this is the last day of the Trump presidency.
But I have to say this really quick. I think what's going to happen, and the reason that Democrats have gotten into this situation, Tracy, the hard left has taken over the party. I'm stating the obvious when I say this. They have backed the Democratic Party into a corner because Democratic leadership has actually facilitated this. Let's be clear. They have coddled, they have encouraged the AOCs, the Tlaibs, the Ilhan Omars, that wing of the party, which are their small donors, their grassroots activists. They have promised them impeachment on the thinnest of pretenses. They thought Mueller was going to get him. They thought, their investigations, they thought Ukraine, they thought all of this stuff would actually create a body of work that would lead to the real impeachment of Donald Trump. Again, it's all conspiracy theories, lies, and there's no there. But they've done this to themselves. They've backed themselves into the corner. They now are caught between their hard left base, who has demanded this, and the American people. For them to win primaries, for them to actually have a chance inside of the party, they have to do this. For them to win the general election, well, they're going to have to face the American people. And I'm telling you, when you see polls, and I'm a poll skeptic, when you're underwater by 22 points on the issue of impeachment with independents, you've got major issues coming your way in 2020.
The worry I have, not worry really, but I don't understand because, like, you know, obviously the media, the propagandists, even the Democrats have made out this socialist wing of the party to be the majority when they're really not the majority at all. I mean, that's why Walkaway became anything. They're not the majority.
They're not. But again, I mean, this is a whole longer conversation about who really drives political parties, who drives the politics here in this country. It's a highly motivated minority. That all to say, the real power, though, in regards to the small dollar donor base and the grassroots activists in the Democratic Party is this very highly, and I would call it, again, this is me being anecdotal here, I don't have a firm figure, probably 25-30% of the Democratic Party being this hard left. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of grassroots power, and they've got the ability to kind of be the rudder that steers the party. And quite frankly, Nancy Pelosi has completely capitulated on this issue. She's speaker in name only because she's afraid of the base. She's afraid of her 25-30% of the hard left base and what they might do to the party in 2020. I'm like, you've gotten yourself in a no-win situation. I honestly think it's going to be a very brutal year for them. You know, Donald Trump's going to sail to re-election. If they are crazy enough to put up an Elizabeth Warren, I think Donald Trump wins 350, 400 electoral votes. He walks away by millions in the popular vote. And then you've got Republicans taking the House back. They keep the Senate, maybe even pick up a few seats in the Senate. And then we go and we have to say we need the right leadership. This is the one thing that has frustrated me for years. We need to have the right leadership in the House. There was an effort that a lot of people don't know about. After the 2016 elections to make a move, Trump was going to make a move to remove Paul Ryan as speaker and put Mark Meadows in. I wish so badly that he had done that. We might have avoided some of this whole stupidity that we've experienced the last 3 years. You got to get real leadership in the House.
Yeah.
Listen, Mitch McConnell's not going anywhere, but as long as he will keep confirming the Federal Society judges that Trump is sending him, okay, I can be at peace with that at some level.
He wants a legacy there for sure.
He does.
And also, Paul Ryan, we're going to go to Flynn for the last couple minutes. How many people Paul Ryan's age have stepped away from politics completely to what was that all about?
What do you mean?
Why do you leave? He stopped running. He stopped being involved. He was a vice presidential. What's going on with Paul Ryan?
I think people woke up to what Paul Ryan really is. I mean, we've known Paul, again, being on the Hill, since he was a staffer for Brownback. Then he went home to Wisconsin, ran for office. So we've known Paul for the last, 20 some years. Who spells his last name wrong, by the way, to be very clear on that front.
I think you should be happy about that.
I am very happy about that. In fact, at one point, really funny story, and we'll get to Flynn. We were at an event and fundraising for my dad, and somebody walked in and said, oh, are you Paul Ryan's son? And I looked at him because I'm 46, sadly. I looked at him like, I am not Paul Ryan's love child because A, I have a different last name, and B, he's only like 2 years older than me, so that wouldn't even work. Right. So the lobbyists just started cracking up and we moved on. But no, I mean, Michael, the fact of the matter is Paul Ryan, I think people woke up to him, understood what he's about. He was really kind of this corporatist influence. I'm not sure he was ever really that interested in solving problems. He wanted to make it look like he was one of the smartest, wonkiest guys on the Hill. But I would say, he realized that his gig was up and might as well move into, being on the fiduciary board of Fox News. Not a good move, I don't think, for us. Back to Michael Flynn, I think at some point, this is what, I make this argument in the book. One of the things that causes republics to end is a bifurcated legal system, a rigged legal system that people use as political weapons against political opponents. Mike Flynn was set up that you cannot deny this. And initially I was not entirely sure about Mike Flynn. This is 3 years ago. I have to tell you now, having a grasp of all the facts, he was ambushed by Comey. He was set up. The thing that's staggering me about what Sullivan did just the other day, oh my gosh, this was a rigged setup system based off false pretenses, based off lies. And you're telling me that this miscarriage of justice, that Mike Flynn is going to be sentenced under it? I've said this on Twitter. I've retweeted other people. Donald Trump needs to pardon Mike Flynn ASAP. If they're going to be stupid enough to try and sentence him off of all of this stupidity, Donald Trump needs to turn around and goes, General Mike Flynn is a great American and patriot. He has been set up. I will not allow this miscarriage of justice and abuse of our legal system to stand. I am pardoning Michael Flynn ASAP.
Yeah, well, so Judge Sullivan, in his response, he actually was kind enough not only to discipline Sidney Powell, which I thought was disgusting, but to also prove the government's case for them with his own version of facts inside of this memo, so that should Michael Flynn decide to, or General Flynn decide to withdraw his plea, the prosecution can hold that up and say, look, the judge says he's guilty. It was something that didn't need to be done. And, it was gross reading from this judge who we really, for all intents and purposes, thought was a fair judge.
An honest broker, right?
Right.
No, I mean, it was actually a little surprising to see Sullivan's comments and the decision that he made and the direction that he's taken. This is what, on a much bigger issue, has become an issue for the American people. They don't even trust their institutions anymore.
Nope. And that's
at some point, if you lose faith and trust in your institutions, all bets are off for society. All bets are off for Republic. And this is my problem with Christopher Wray over the FBI. Listen, buddy, you're going to have to make a decision. Are you going to protect and defend a corrupt institution, or are you going to protect and defend the Constitution? You can't do both. And the Constitution is the basis for our institutions. And if you will not defend the constitutional rights and actually cause real reform and consequences to take place for what the FBI did, I mean, you're undermining the Constitution, thereby undermining your institution. We've got real issues. I mean, when people start to lose faith in their institutions and the concepts of rule of law, it's frightening to think all bets are off for society. But I have to say this, Tracy, so I can get a pitch in. If people want to get a copy of the book,
I was just about to do this.
They've got to go to Amazon. They've got to go to Amazon, Restoring Our Republic at Amazon. I am going to do this too, though. I am putting up a link on my website, nedryun.com, nedryun.com, where they can order a personalized autographed copy, but they will not get it before Christmas. If you want the book before Christmas, you got to go through Amazon.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm going to get another one now.
See, there you go.
Yeah, I'll give this one to you, Frank. I can send you this one, and I'll take the fancy one.
Oh, awesome.
You can go to nedryun.com and you can purchase the book Restoring Our Republic, The Making of the Republic and How We Reclaim It Before It's Too Late. And follow Ned on Twitter. Great follow at Ned Ryan, NedRyun on Twitter. Fantastic follow. Really, really great to have you today. Does Barr fix it all real quick before we go? Does he fix it? What does he do?
I think John Durham is coming like God's justice. I would remind people that it is a criminal investigation. Grand juries have already been impaneled. I don't see Bill Barr pulling punches like Horowitz did. I think Bill Barr is interested in doing what Christopher Wray is not interested in actually reforming institutions. And I think that's why he's sticking around. I think he will stick around to make sure institutions are reformed before he moves on. I have hope that Bill Barr and John Durham will set things right once we get through this stupid impeachment and Donald Trump is on his way to victory next year. Don't forget, the Durham investigation will probably have some results for us to see, probably in the spring, for sure by summer. That will dramatically change the narrative for 2020, and I think be of great benefit to Donald Trump in his reelection bid, because people are going to understand this is as bad as we thought it was, a massive abuse of power, massive corruption, and I do think Bill Barr is going to do his best to set things right.
From your lips to God's ears. Thanks so much, Ned, for joining us today for the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Ned.
Guys.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer quick fix on Radio Influence.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week on City Ringside, presented by CBS Sports HQ, we are honored to talk to the guitarist for Lynyrd Skynyrd, founder of Blackfoot, and a huge wrestling fan. Yes, I'm talking about Ricky Medlock. He's going to talk about starting out with Lynyrd Skynyrd, why he left the band, and did he have any regrets, the infamous plane crash, and an incredible story about why he wasn't on that plane. Also, becoming a wrestling fan, who his favorites were in championship wrestling from Florida growing up as a kid, and who he roots for now. Plus, an in-depth conversation about the fabulous Freebirds and the impression that they made in the wrestling business and the music business. Ricky Medlock, this week on City Ringside, presented by CBS Sports HQ.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.